The headlines. Newly released satellite images show that Israel, which is widely believed to possess hundreds of nuclear warheads, is significantly expanding its Dimona nuke facility. UN documents show private military contractors, including infamous Blackwater, helped flow American weapons into Libya in 2019. Millions of people in the U.S. state of Texas lack access to clean water, and many are facing food shortages after a historic cold blast. Thanks for joining us. Newly released satellite images reveal a significant construction work at Israel's Dimona nuclear site. An independent group of arms control and non-proliferation experts known as the International Panel on Fissile Material published the images on Thursday. The group's website says the construction has expanded in the Negev desert and appears to be actively underway. Israel is believed to be the only possessor of nukes in West Asia and estimated to have between 200 and 400 atomic warheads in its arsenal. Israel neither admits nor denies having the nukes, but activists have warned time and again of the enormous threats posed by Israel's nuclear activities. Israel has so far defied international calls to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty and never allowed any inspection of its nuclear facilities. Senior geopolitical analyst Alexander Azadgan says the international community is largely hypocritical in its approach toward Israel's nuclear program.
What was leaked to us by this Israeli nuclear whistleblower, Mordechai Vanunu, and does estimate that Israel has and maintains at least 90 nuclear warheads that have been produced from plutonium. This is something very important because Iran is being accused of this. But to make the matters worse, as everyone knows, Israel is not, like you mentioned, a signatory of NPT, and neither does any of its facilities subject to the IAEA inspection. While all along, not just during the past 5 years, not since July of 2015 that the Iranian nuclear deal was signed, but going back to 12 years prior to that, the Iranian facilities have been inspected, minus the military sites, but the rest of them were literally the most scrutinized nuclear program in human history. There is tremendous hypocrisy here and inconsistency.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Washington's so-called policy of maximum pressure against Iran has not produced results. Blinken made the comments in his first international interview with the BBC. He stressed that his country is not offering Iran any upfront concessions to bring it to the negotiating table. Blinken said if Iran returns to compliance with its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal, the U.S. would do the same. The top diplomat added that Washington and its European allies share the same objectives concerning the Iran nuclear deal. He said that other issues, including Iran's ballistic missile programs and its regional activities, also needed to be addressed. That is while President Joe Biden earlier announced his readiness to re-engage with parties to the Iran deal.
We're prepared to re-engage in negotiations with the P5 plus one on Iran's nuclear program. We must also address Iran's destabilizing activities across the Middle East. And we're going to work in close cooperation with our European and other partners as we proceed.
Meanwhile, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says Washington has no plans to ease sanctions on Iran. She says the U.S. would not issue an executive order about returning to the nuclear deal before possible talks with Iran and the major powers. That is while Tehran has repeatedly said that Washington should lift sanctions on Iran first before the country resumes its nuclear commitments suspended as per the terms of the JCPOA. Political analyst Tohid Asadi says that when it comes to Iran's nuclear program, the Biden administration is following the same path that the Trump administration did, only with some verbal differences.
Practically speaking, at least when it comes to Iran's nuclear program, what we have seen so far is that Biden is trying to follow the same trajectory that Trump administration did, with a slight difference, and that is related to the statements. So they are trying to put forth some arguments based upon the claim that they're trying to fix things. But when it comes to practice, things are almost the same as they used to be during the Trump administration. So far, Iran has seen nothing in practice except for some verbal statements coming from European Union and a unilateral withdrawal from the United States. I think Iran's policy in this regard is very much clear and easy to understand.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says that the country's offensive on the city of Ma'arib is aimed at driving out, quote, Saudi-backed aggressors and their backers. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the enemies of Yemen are trying to bring the nation under their yoke. However, he stressed that the Yemenis will not be controlled by Riyadh, Washington, or by Israel. Ansarullah leader added that the people of his country will continue to fight for their freedom. The remarks come as Ansarullah is carrying out an offensive to take control of Ma'arib, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen. Sana'a has accused the militants of using civilians as human shields to hold back Ansarullah troops. Yemenis have gathered in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a to renew their demands for the international community to release detained oil vessel by the Saudi-led coalition. The detention of vessels has left the impoverished nation with a harsh fuel crisis. The Latif al-Washali has more.
Yemenis have come together before the UN office in Sana'a to call on the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition into releasing detained oil vessels. The detention of oil vessels has left the country in desperate struggle to survive amid a harsh shortage of fuel.
We have lots of problems amid fuel shortage. We stay here for days to get some liters of gasoline due to the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition and the continued detention of oil ships. We call on those who are after making concessions against the enemies to stand firm when it comes to the basic needs of Yemeni people.
Major sectors including health have warned that they may collapse in a few days if the detained oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition are not immediately released. Thousands of facilities have already stopped providing services due to a lack of fuel.
The situation today is entirely catastrophic, especially in the health sector. The petroleum company is unable to provide health facilities with the oil derivatives. 50 days have passed and not even a lease has been allowed to enter the port of Hodeidah. The U.S. and the U.N. bear responsibility of what is happening in Yemen.
The Saudi-led coalition is still holding 14 Yemeni oil ships illegally as they were inspected and authorized by the United Nations through verification and inspection mechanism. Hundreds of cars take days in long lines in front of the only working gas station in Sana'a. Yemenis say overcoming this dire situation needs a real action by the international community to step in and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
UN documents show private military contractors, including infamous Blackwater, had helped flow American weapons into Libya for an assault on the UN-backed government there. UN experts have obtained documents in an 18-month investigation that shed new light on Washington's weapons proliferation regime. They indicate that private security firms attempted to bring Western military experts, as well as equipment such as drones, speedboats, and assault weapons, into Libya in 2019. That's in order to assist renegade General Khalifa Haftar, who was seeking to take control of the country with the backing of some Arab states, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Any transfer of U.S. weapons to a third party is a potential violation of U.N. arms embargoes, as well as America's own laws. But instances reported by the media and rights groups suggest that American arms have often ended up in Libya in violation of the U.N. Charter. Millions of people in the U.S. state of Texas lack access to clean water after an unprecedented winter storm wreaked havoc across much of the country's southern and central parts this week. Texans were seen queuing up for hours on Friday to have safe drinking water and food. The disruption of water and food supplies comes amid record low temperatures that damaged the state's infrastructure and utilities. The deadly polar blast also caused a widespread blackout. The Texas governor says that more than 160,000 people are still without electricity. President Joe Biden has planned to sign a major disaster declaration for the state. He also called on federal authorities to coordinate disaster relief in neighboring states of Louisiana and Oklahoma that are also hit by the extreme weather. At least 40 people have so far died by the winter storm across the U.S. A report from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security shows right-wing extremists were responsible for the majority of terrorist attacks in the country in 2020. The report is based on a review of last year's domestic terror incidents. This is the first time that the U.S. government has publicly acknowledged the rise of right-wing violence despite being documented and investigated in the past. The report comes just weeks after supporters of former President Donald Trump, many of them members of extremist groups, attacked a U.S. Congress. Following the January 6th incident, the new administration called for a review of domestic extremism, describing it as a serious and growing national security threat. Another independent report also indicates that white supremacists and other extremist groups had hatched the two-thirds of terror plots in the U.S. in the first 8 months of 2020. Argentina's health minister has resigned over claims of improper COVID-19 vaccine allocation. Genius Gonzalez Garcia stepped down after it emerged that some of his friends sidestepped proper procedure for vaccinations. The resignation was tendered on the request of President Alberto Fernandez on Friday. Gonzalez Garcia, a 75-year-old doctor, will be replaced by one of his deputy ministers, Carla Bizzotti. Local media have reported that other people close to the government were also vaccinated at the health ministry without following the procedure. This is why Argentina just started vaccination the elderly on Wednesday after giving the jabs to healthcare workers. Argentina has recorded some 2 million COVID cases and more than 50,000 deaths. Anti-coup protesters have taken to the streets of Myanmar amid simmering anger over the death of a young woman activist shot by security forces. Thousands of demonstrators marched through the streets of the capital in Naypyidaw and its townships. They chanted slogans against the military, held signs calling for the immediate release of ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Over the past few days, thousands more Myanmaris have joined an ongoing civil disobedience campaign. On Friday, a 20-year-old woman became the first fatality among opponents of the coup. She was hit by a live bullet during a rally last week. The Southeast Asian nation has been the scene of protests since the military seized power on February the 1st. According to a political prisoners monitoring group, over 500 people have been detained since then. Human Rights Watch accuses Indian authorities of adopting laws and policies that systematically discriminate against Muslims and stigmatize government critics. In a report, the leading rights group said prejudices embedded in the government of the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party have infiltrated independent institutions. This, the report said, has enabled nationalist groups to threaten, harass, and attack religious minorities with impunity. The report comes ahead of the first anniversary of communal violence in Delhi that killed 53 people, mostly Muslims. The deadly attacks followed months of peaceful protests by Indians of all faiths against the government's discriminatory policies, including a controversial citizenship law. Kevin Barrett, an expert on Islamic issues, says the government of the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has institutionalized racism against Muslims.
Modi's India is notorious now for its institutionalizing this racism and this anti-Islam sentiment that is in fact the backbone really of Modi's whole political organization. You know, his party has been this extremist kind of pro-ethnic cleansing party that's always been marginalized in India. And that party has been around for a century, but up until recently, it was on the margins. And then in a process not unlike the way that the Nazi party took over Germany, Modi's party has moved to the center of Indian politics. And as they've gone from the margins to the center, they have brought this vision of ethnically cleansing the entire Indian subcontinent of Muslims. They want it to be a Hindu-only subcontinent.
And staying with India, Rohingya refugees living in camps across India have been terrified amid renewed fears that the government may arrest them for illegally entering the country. Scores of them have been arrested since last month. As Munawar Zaman reports, this has triggered panic among the community.
In Rohingya refugee camp in the outskirts of New Delhi, there is an utter panic and the residents are fearful even going out to buy the essentials. They say many are chased, intimidated, and usually police and other agencies visit their camps to monitor their movements. Ali Johar, a young Rohingya refugee, says several have been arrested in the recent months and put into jails for illegally entering India, saying the whole community is in utter despair.
Around 60 people have been arrested in the different parts of India, including West Bengal, Manipur, Assam, Haryana, and Delhi. In Delhi, around 8 people were detained. In Haryana, several families were harassed to leave out from Haryana.
Fearful of possible arrest and expulsion, scores of refugees have gone into hiding across the Indian subcontinent, while others have entered Bangladesh amid a mounting hate campaign against the community in India. The destitute community who has escaped what the United Nations described genocide is struggling for existence amid international silence about their plight. An estimated 40,000 are living in India. The community has faced a brutal crackdown by the army in their country, such as rape, murder, child killings, arbitrary arrests, forced disappearances, as well as destruction of the entire Rohingya villages. Now many fear that the military coup might make the situation even worse. Some reports suggest hundreds of Rohingya are being held in Indian jails on charges of illegal entry and have no proper judicial support. Their men are unable to find work due to lack of identity cards and threats of intimidation by law enforcement agencies forcing men to stay at their camps.
We have been living here peacefully since 2012. We came to save our lives, but the police and other agencies are usually coming to our camps for questioning, asking our IDs, and this has become a routine. We are terrified and we can't even sleep, thinking what would happen to us.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion, while the government describes them as a security threat. Observers say the Rohingya refugees in particular have in the past and present been used largely for political reasons in this part of the world. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
And that is the problem.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Phase of the revolution. Of the revolution. Of the revolution. Leap in production. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has chosen economic themes for 13 consecutive Iranian calendar years. This approach has been based on a prudent and broad-minded goal to strengthen the pillars of national economy and turn Iran into an economic power not only in the region but in the world. The year 1387 was named the Year of Innovation and Prosperity, and the years following also got similar names. In the advent of the second phase of the Islamic Revolution, the leader named the current year as the Year of Leap in Production to give an impetus to the issue of production and further accelerate it to achieve the economic objectives already envisaged in the past years. We are going to dwell upon the issue in a series titled Second Phase of the Revolution, Leap in Production. Stay tuned, please. Experts believe that the continuation of the current course is not effective in the progress of production, and there should be more practical and scientific measure to correct the status quo and bring all existing capacities and capabilities to the scene. Industrial countries have gained successful experiences in the issue of leap in production. Countries like Japan, South Korea, and China have made great breakthroughs in the issue of production. Hence, they have reduced their distance with the advanced countries and even turned into the pioneers in some spheres of industry and technology. This great move, which has been dubbed as leap in production by the leader, enjoys specifications and prerequisites. Ayatollah Khamenei outlined the future course of the Islamic Revolution in his fully comprehensive statement known as the Second Step or Second Phase of the Revolution. He highlights in the statement that strengthening production and making economy resistant requires a jihadi resolve and motive and a belief in the principle of we can. Iran has gained precious experiences, especially during the 8-year Holy Defense, to implement huge projects. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, has called on all producers and economic activists to take long strides in the course of progress of the country. Leap in production can be evaluated as a key strategy in the course of the second phase of the revolution. Moving in this course depends on many factors. One of these factors with a direct impact on strengthening the economy is the existence of rich resources and reserves in the country. As for the economy of resistance, the more a country manages to apply its endogenous capacities and uses the existing conditions in interaction with the economy of other countries, the more successful it will be. In view of this, leap in production should be carried out through simultaneous change of major economic plans and methods of production. These changes should be directed toward economic concepts, while moral and religious values are fully observed in economic affairs. Economic institutes cannot go through leap and major development unless the economic and commercial behaviors change proportionately. A strong economy requires proper growth and heeding all parameters of economic leap. The economy of Japan can be a role model in this field. The Japanese economy suffered fatal damages during the Second World War, but after the war, the country focused on production and achieved economic growth exponentially. After the Second World War, Japan banned the imports of commodities and products and empowered old workshops and industries to promote domestic production. Thus, after opening its doors to the outside world, it was able to compete with foreign products. Therefore, enjoying skillful workforce and specialized industrialists, Japan succeeded to build up modern industries in mid-19th century. Countries like India and Brazil, too, have used the strategy of replacement of imports by indigenous production to boost economy. Other countries like South Korea and Turkey have had an external approach and chose the strategy of exports. However, Iran, due to enjoying great generating capacities in the economic fields, needs the pattern of resistance economy. In other words, it needs fresh plans and native programming in various domains to attain the pinnacles of growth.
The debate.
The United Nations says Yemen is speeding towards the worst famine seen in decades due to years of war. UN Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock said 16 million people are going hungry across Yemen. This is while Yemen's Supreme Council for Management of Humanitarian Affairs says that Saudi-backed militants are using civilians and displaced people as human shields in the ongoing clashes in Yemen's city of Ma'arib. On Thursday, Ansarullah deployed troops to the city of Ma'arib, which is a stronghold of loyalists of the former Yemeni government. The Daesh terrorist group has also openly confirmed that its members are fighting alongside Saudi-backed mercenaries against Yemen's army and popular forces in the province of Ma'arib. Well, the country has been devastated by a war waged by Saudi Arabia and its allies since March 2015. The kingdom has also imposed an all-out blockade that has hampered aid imports to Yemen.
The fighting is escalating in the city of Ma'arib, which is the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in the north of the war-torn country. On Thursday, the Ansarullah movement and allied army units ordered a wide deployment of troops to Ma'arib, saying the move is aimed at protecting Yemeni citizens. The deployment came as reports surfaced suggesting grave human rights violations by Riyadh loyalists. Yemen's Supreme Council for Management of Humanitarian Affairs said Saudi-backed militants are using civilians and displaced people as human shields in the ongoing clashes in Ma'arib. The council said Saudi Arabia and its allies bear responsibility for endangering civilian lives. Meanwhile, the Saudi-led coalition has also redeployed troops to the region and increased airstrikes against Ansarullah positions there. The United Nations has urged warring sides to stop their offensive on Ma'arib and called for an immediate ceasefire.
The attack on Ma'arib must stop. It puts millions of civilians at risk, as Mark has been commenting this week, and especially with the fighting threatening to reach the camps for internally displaced persons.
The UN also warned about a looming famine in Yemen, which the world body said would be the worst on the planet in decades due to years of war. UN humanitarian chief Mark Lowcock said 16 million people are going hungry across Yemen, including 5 million who are just one step away from famine. The UN official also highlighted the high records of malnutrition rate among Yemeni people. Yemen has been devastated by the war waged by Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies and backed by the US and European countries, such as Britain and France in March 2015. The kingdom has conducted airstrikes on its southern impoverished neighbor almost on a daily basis. It has also imposed an all-out blockade that has hampered even humanitarian aid deliveries to Yemen. The new US administration has been making a fuss about ending the Saudi war on Yemen and ensuring that humanitarian aid reached the Yemeni people. Despite the claims, Washington has failed to take practical measures to push its major regional allies, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, to end their deadly war against their conflict-plagued Arab country.
Well, joining us on this debate, we have Director of Human Rights for Yemen, Kim Sharif, joining us from the British capital, London. Also, we have Manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas El Najem, joining us from Toronto. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Ms. Sharif in London. Yemen's Supreme Council of Humanitarian Affairs has reported that Saudi-backed militants are using civilians and displaced people as human shields in the ongoing clashes in Yemen's city of Ma'arib, and that Saudi Arabia and its allies bear responsibility for endangering civilian lives. Talk to us more about that also. That condemnation has not been echoed by the likes of the UN or the United States. And also, if you may, tell us, why is the Ma'arib battle so vital right now?
Well, good evening to you, and thank you for the invite to join the debate. Basically, the background to what's happening in Ma'arib in particular is that the oil of Yemen was being stolen and continues to be stolen by the Western-backed Saudi coalition team and their mercenaries. And of course, the income from all that oil revenue was being has been diverted for the purchase of hotels, villas, and lots of other real estate properties in Cairo, in Istanbul, and even in London. I have seen evidence of that. Basically, what's happening is that the international community doesn't want the Yemen army and its popular committees to advance in Ma'arib because it stands to lose a great deal of oil revenue that it's stealing from Yemen today. I'm not just making this claim. This matter was being investigated by the French authorities, I believe, about a year ago. We revealed that about 4 years ago that Yemen oil was being stolen in favor of the Saudi-led coalition via the French oil giant Total. And I believe that investigation is still ongoing. And that's one of the reasons why they don't want the Yemen army to advance in Ma'arib. That's one point. The second point is, as your reporter has just confirmed, the most dangerous terrorist groups in the world, in Yemen today, are fighting alongside Saudi-led coalition forces. I'm glad they have finally come out and confirmed this. This was confirmed by BBC report Safar Ahmed. This was confirmed by CNN, whereby American weapons are ending up in the hands of ACAP and Daesh. This has been confirmed by what we found when we regained Al Bayda. We found nationalities from Chechnya, from Pakistan, from Afghanistan, from many other countries. All the known usual terrorists were there. Why? What are they doing in Al Bayda? They were brought in there by the Saudi-led coalition. They don't have ground forces. Their ground forces consist of terrorist outfits such as Daesh and Aqab, as well as mercenaries they get from Sudan, Senegal, and elsewhere. That's the other reason. They want Yemen to continue to have terrorism problems so that it can give the right. Americans and their allies the right to come and attack Yemen, as they have been doing for the past 60 years. So we don't have terrorism in the parts controlled by Sana'a government by comparison. You will see that Sana'a government is the only one that's fighting terrorism in Yemen today.
Ms. Sharif, hold that thought. Let's bring in our guest from Toronto, Mr. Firas al-Najim. The United Nations says that Yemen is speeding towards the worst famine on the planet. Top UN officials have also warned that this massive famine could wipe out any fresh peace efforts. The UN humanitarian chief, Mark Lowcock, said 16 million people are going hungry across Yemen. Yet we're still witnessing international inaction to relieve the suffering of the Yemeni people. Why has this war been dragged out for so long?
Well, you know, it's quite clear we want this war to keep dragging on and keep going because there's a plan behind it. And the U.S. and the British and the French are the ones giving all the logistical support to this war. Like, they're behind and they have, you know, some of the strongest power inside the United Nations. And it's up to them to delay this war. It's up to them to stop this war. It's up to them to put sanctions against Saudi Arabia. We know Saudi Arabia is one of the biggest human rights violators in the whole Middle Eastern region. We know that they are a monarchy, tribal, tyrannical regime that does not respect human rights whatsoever. They don't have any human rights organizations operating inside their country. We see what they do to their own civilians in their country. We see what they do to any opposition members inside their country. We see what they do to other countries when you know, people stand up for their rights, such as Bahrain, and they intervened and they went there and they occupied that place as well. They've been committing massive amounts of human rights abuses and massacres, you know, war crimes in Yemen. We've been seeing it now. We're going into 6 years of a war, right? And we know it's obviously an illegitimate war from the beginning because the Yemeni people rose up peacefully to change the system that's there. We've heard Mark speak before. We've heard Ban Ki-moon before, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, speaking about it's the worst famine, it's the worst humanitarian crisis. But what's been done? When has Saudi Arabia ever been and their coalition held accountable for all these human rights abuses and all these war crimes? Nothing. We hear it sometimes. One time there was a certain labeling of trials by the United Nations, and then they pulled back and retracted that because of some bullying, because of some bribing, because of some blackmail. I mean, this is what the United Nations today. Today, United Nations is a tool for certain countries, and they can exercise the plans that they want and the projects they want. And then before they said we'll pull out of the International Criminal Court, we won't even recognize them. We won't recognize the Human Rights Commission inside the United Nations. They said it was, you know, it's not operating right, so we just pull out. So pretty much we don't even care about what's happening within human rights in the United Nations. So it's a very biased system. It's a very unfair system. And, I mean, like, Yemen is the worst humanitarian crisis. We see the pictures every day. We've seen the famine. We've seen the children dying. Where is humanity? That's the question. Where is all these countries that are still ongoing and justifying supplying arms deals? You know, Canada, one of the countries that I'm living in here, our government here is supplying the biggest arms deal to Saudi Arabia continuously, and it's continuing, even though they know what's happening in Yemen.
Okay.
You know, this hypocrisy must stop, you know, and we as you...
Let's cross over back to London, Kim Sharif. U.S. President Joe Biden announced an anti-U.S. support for the Saudi-led military offensive in Yemen, indicating that the new administration in Washington is planning a more active role in efforts to end the country's war and the crisis there. The question is, will Washington act on those comments? Because ending support doesn't mean that the war will just end.
Indeed. We have had nothing but total hypocrisy from the U.S. regime. I mean, Mr. Biden must be reminded that his administration was in charge when this aggression on Yemen was announced in Washington on 26 March 2015. And if it hadn't been for U.S.'s full backing, and I actually suspect a command to the Saudi-led coalition to put together this coalition and attack Yemen, this war wouldn't have started in the first place. There is no mandate from the UN to invite or to let or allow anyone to use force against Yemen. If it hadn't been for U.S. bullying and involvement, and as I said, I sincerely believe this is U.S.'s war, and this is Mr. Biden's attempt at trying to play the Mr. Nice diplomat now that they have failed miserably in occupying Yemen completely and colonizing it, which is what they wanted to do from the start. And now between Britain and the U.S., they're playing the good cop, the bad cop scenario on us, whereby Britain continues to supply weapons, but the U.S. will start to play the nice diplomat who is going to make every effort to stop. For God's sake, it's very straightforward. If he really is genuine about what he's saying, I put him to the test here by inviting Mr. Biden to go to the Security Council tomorrow and pass a resolution demanding forthwith cessation of hostilities against the state of Yemen by the Saudi-led coalition and forthwith lifting of the illegal blockade. And then I will believe him and trust him. But then meanwhile, while he continues to make these statements, look, we need to see action on the ground. We don't want empty statements and good cop, bad cop scenario won't work with us. Yes. Let's just trace it. Saudi-led coalition have been defeated. They are using civilians as a human shield in Marib, simply because they are terrified witless. Once Marib has returned to the sovereignty of the state of Yemen, that is basically the end of Saudi-led coalition. They will have no leg to stand in continuing their aggression against Yemen, which is why their Western backers are also making noises about Marib. They're saying all warring parties. What do you mean by all warring parties? This is an aggression by the U.S. Okay. and the U.K. through Saudi-led coalition.
Mr. Al-Najim, I saw you nodding there, reacting to the news of Joe Biden's comments that the U.S. wants to stop its support for the Saudi aggression. Yemen's Supreme Political Council back then said that Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements. They want to see action also. Why should the Yemenis even trust Washington? In fact, just as Ms. Sharif just mentioned, in 2015, it was the Obama administration, along with Mr. Biden, that gave Riyadh the support in the first place.
Yes, that's very clear. Obviously, that Obama sparked this war at his time, and this person, Biden, is on the same system and same team, and he's gonna be, when he's promoting for his campaign, he's gonna try to use all kinds of different, marketing tools to get into power. That he's going to stop this and stop that, but like he came in right now, and we see now the war is intensifying in Marib and different areas. He could easily pull the plug on the Saudis and stop this war and stop the arms deal right ahead and adopt a resolution in the United Nations to stop the war. Right? They got veto power inside the United Nations, so it's a very easy war. The Saudi regime itself is living on the oxygen tank of the American system and regime. So it's very quickly. The thing is, they just don't want resistance in the area. I would like to add to Kim's comment about how this is. It's also there to secure Israel. So it's a U.S.-Israeli war, pretty much. And it's there to secure the interest of securing Israel, because they know that Ansar Allah are part of the axis or the unity of the resistance groups in the Middle East. And this all sparked at the time of 1979, where Imam Khomeini did his revolution, and he fought the colonial powers that they want to control the area, all these, Western countries that want to set up their bases and start wars and sell arms to these guys and plunder the resources of the region. And Ansar Allah is part of that axis, and this is a very dangerous area because of Bab al-Mandab also. It's a water pathway that is needed for them to bring their ships and their, dock all their planes on there, their fighter jets, and bring in all their supplies to support Israel and to support the control and the bases of the region. So this is their main danger. They don't want a strong government, a sovereign government, a legitimate government. What is Ansar Allah? Ansar Allah has other political factions that are all Yemeni, and they're people that were inside the country. They didn't come from outside. There's not one Iranian person inside Iran, except maybe the ambassador that just recently got in there. So this is a very big joke whenever they say the Iranians are behind this, the Iranians are running the show. Where is the Iranians? You have not captured one Iranian. Have you had one prisoner of war that's Iranian till now, so you can even show some kind of credibility or even justify or even make up a scenario? They haven't even been able to make make up a scenario where they find some Iranians, you know, and do something like this. This shows that everything they're doing is illegitimate, it's fraudulent, it's all fake, and it's all evil. And, you know, the only way it's going to happen, I think, is by the Yemeni unity and their defense and their deterrence. Like, these guys are, you know, they're powerful. Like, you know, when Biden had to pull their name off the terrorist list, this shows how strong they are and how big of negotiators they're going to be in the future. So we believe that the Yemeni government, Ansarullah, the Houthis are the victorious ones, and they will defeat all these coalitions.
Kim Sharif, we were talking about Joe Biden's campaign trail. On the campaign trail, Joe Biden said, and I quote, "We will in fact make the Saudis the pariah that they are, and they have to be held accountable for murdering children in Yemen." Well, the Saudis right now, they aren't even on the UN's child killer blacklist. What does that mean?
Well, it's quite right. I'm glad you make that quote, because these were quite a few of his quotes before the election. He made the mandate. He promised the people of the U.S. that if he is voted into power, he will do these things. But so far, not so good. The one good thing he's done is obviously removing the designation that was quite irrational and frankly illegal and unworkable, because it's designating the entire Yemeni population as terrorists, which is impossible. The only terrorists in Yemen are those people working for them, ACAP and Daesh, as they have quite clearly made a statement yesterday confirming that. Joe Biden, I mean, I want to tell you about another important thing. He said he was going to care for children. What about women? Last couple of weeks, Saudi-led coalition mercenaries in Marib kidnapped 8 women, beaten them with the gun butts, and pulled their hairs. One of them just gave birth 2 weeks earlier. They refused to let her take her child to breast. One of the 8 women was tortured to death, and 7 of them were sold on to Saudi regime. That is human trafficking in a worst case scenario in the middle of this war. These women have done nothing. They were mere internally displaced people living in tents and places like that. And so Joe Biden, just like many other Western politicians, they say something, but then in reality they do completely the opposite. And they always find good excuses to get away from it. At the moment, so far, it sounds like he has avoided speaking to Bin Salman. He hasn't spoken to him, and he made statements that if he is to deal with the Saudi regime, he's going to be communicating with Salman directly, and good luck to him, and know how to manage Alzheimer's situations. I hope he does. So he needs to do more than just say, I'm not going to be on speaking terms with this man who stands accused of brutally murdering Khashoggi in breach of all kinds of laws, laws of the heavens and laws of the earth, and disrespect to other people's jurisdictions and so forth. Mm-hmm. So we need to see more from Mr. Biden. Enough. He's now past the stage of election sound bites. He's now in power. He needs to act as the real president, right, and do the right thing and go and pass that resolution at the UN Security Council and deal with Sana'a government directly in the usual diplomatic channels, okay, because he will find them the best partners in the war against terror.
One last question for Mr. Al-Najim in Toronto before we leave. The Daesh terrorist group has openly confirmed that its members are fighting alongside the Saudi-backed mercenaries in Marib. A lot of other data points in the direction that the Saudi-led coalition and its mercenaries and even Washington have been fighting alongside Takfiri terror outfits such as Daesh and Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Share with us your thoughts on that issue before we leave.
Well, I mean, it's nothing shocking at all, because the Wahhabi state-sponsored doctrine of Saudi Arabia, that's what they are, the Wahhabi sect. And the Wahhabi sect is the doctrine that's a deviant, and that is an extremist doctrine that has, you know, obviously is far away from the real Islam. And these people are working based on this doctrine right now, and they just don't have a government. So they're just, lawless people on the ground.
All right. We're fresh out of time of this program. Allow me to thank my guest, Director of Human Rights for Yemen, Ms. Kim Sharif, joining us from London. Also, thanks to Manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Mr. Firas Al-Najim, speaking to us from Toronto. Also, special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and we have Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for being here. So there have been some major interesting developments taking place in the world. Particularly, I'd like to take it to the area of Biden coming into power. Biden's now in power, and he's made some moves which some would see as revealing, and others would see as highly deceptive. And I'd like to talk about this in regards to Yemen in particular. As you know, the new president of America, Biden, has apparently removed Ansarullah from the list of terrorists, the terrorist list, which is what everybody's calling it nowadays. I'd like to go first to Sayyid Mahdi and ask him about this.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's always wonderful to be on the program with you, esteemed brothers. I think one of the things here, before we talk about the removal of Ansarullah from these sanctions, it's kind of important to have a background on this Yemen war. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, it has, to a large extent, been ignored by the global media, by the mass media. It's a war that has not been brought to the forefront, despite the fact that it has incurred huge damages, a huge humanitarian crisis, where you have a majority of the population who is on the brink of starvation. There's lack of water, there's lack of food, there's lack of clean medical facilities, you know, and the basic diseases which come from a lack of basic infrastructure is prevalent in the country. It's interesting, Yemen was one of the richest and wealthiest Arab countries
in the past.
Like way in the past.
Way in the past, meaning before the colonial imperial powers went mm-hmm. and broke up the country.
Right.
So it's not really farther back, right? The first colonial power person that was placed in there was Ali Abdullah Saleh.
Mm-hmm.
After that, you had this other guy, I think is Mansur al-Rabi, is his name, the mm-hmm. guy who fled mm-hmm. During the current crisis. But the war on Yemen really is a catastrophical war, which has caused a lot of damage. And it should also be known that it was the Saudis and the Saudi government who started this war. Talking about the removal of Ansarullah, I think first we should also talk about putting Ansarullah on the terrorist list and then talk about putting them off the terrorist list. And I would like to go ahead and pass it on to our next
Sheikh Ali, I'd like to bring you in here.
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So talking about Yemen, as Sayyid has pointed out, we have to look at the history. When did the war start? It's been over 6 years, I believe, that Yemen has been under very severe conditions in terms of, being a war-stricken country. And in addition to that, the basic necessities of life, which are for every human being, it's something that is a must-have. They're lacking in Yemen, from medication to clean water to, food and, just the very bare minimum basic necessities. Now, we have to see, the background. Why were they attacked to begin with, and who attacked them, and what is the scheme and plot behind it?
Mm.
So when you look at the U.S. administration, it wanted to suppress the dignified nation of Yemen so it does not join the resistance camp, the mm-hmm. camp of resistance. That's where it all begins, right? And then who gets used in this whole thing? It's Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia being the neighbor of Yemen, they started to attack Yemenis, and Yemenis in defense started to retaliate, which is their natural and inalienable right?
Human right, yeah.
So this is where it all begins, right? Now, they were expecting that this war is going to last a few days with all the modern technology and ammunition and, unwavering support of the United States government to the Saudi regime, the rogue Saudi regime. They expected it to last just a few days. And then, they expected that Yemenis are just going to be on their knees and they're going to give in.
Mm.
But turned out to their surprise that Yemenis resisted. And they stood tall against this ongoing oppression. Even till today, they are fighting it back. So they're not giving in.
And I just want to quickly add that the reason they thought that they would give in so quickly is because while what Sayyid Mahdi said was correct, that in colonial times they were very rich, in modern times Yemen is one of the poorest countries in the world.
Exactly.
If not
they
the
didn't have
country.
The cutting edge machinery, mm. they didn't have technology, they didn't have anything. All they have is that dignity and of course their sincerity and their loyalty to Islam
mm-hmm.
and to their nation.
Mm.
So they stood up and they gave a hard time to Saudi. In retaliation, that Aramco thing, so they upgraded themselves to a point where they could attack the enemy back
yeah.
in retaliation, right? And this was, again, a big, huge surprise for the camp of arrogance or the enemies.
Mm.
And it was so obvious that, okay, now Yemenis are at a point where, with the help of the axis of resistance, right, where Iran is there, where Hezbollah is there, the other resistance players in the region who are looking at this uncalled